Hey friends, this week I wanted to do something a little bit different and rebroadcast an interview I had a few years ago with Rachel Held Evans. I know this is kind of coming late, but I still thought it was important. Most of you know that Rachel passed away a few weeks ago, and I noticed that there had been a lot of people listening to this old episode with her for understandable reasons, and so wanted to rebroadcast it and let people hear it again for a few reasons. I know a lot of you are hurting out there because of what Rachel meant to you, and I really do get it. As I got the news, like most of you did, seeing it online, I was recalling, obviously, this conversation I had with her and the small little interactions I had with her online and what her writings had meant to me. And like a lot of people were. You know, the weird thing is that I was also thinking, after thinking of her family, her husband and children and all that entails, I was thinking about, oddly enough, her detractors. I was telling somebody, it was obvious to me that Rachel received extra vitriol from certain people, simply because she was a woman. That seemed really obvious to me. Now, that's not to say that everyone who had disagreements with her was inappropriate or had vitriol, but I just noticed there were a lot of people who should have known better, who talked to her in a way I couldn't imagine them talking to a man. And so that's sad. And it's really sad because Rachel was just such a wonderful person, even for the people that I think she disagreed with. And when you talk to her, it would be incredibly difficult not to like her. And those people missed out on that. And so I think that's a good lesson for us, for those that we disagree with. Even if we're right, if we dehumanize them, if we see them as less than, then we've lost. We've lost. In Christianity, you know, if you speak with tongues of angels but have not love, then you miss the point. So I'm going to stop there. To talk with Rachel was to see her as your friend, and I think you'll probably hear that in my voice in this interview. So I hope you enjoy. My guest today is Rachel Held Evans. Rachel is an award-winning writer and author whose articles have appeared in local and national publications. She lives in Dayton, Tennessee with her husband, Dan. Rachel, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You were in Austin, my current hometown, last year, and you and Scott McKnight were speaking at one of the local seminaries here.
Oh, yeah. That's the one where they asked me about parakoesis.
Oh, that was the one, huh?
I didn't know what they were talking about. All the Presbyterians with their big words. They asked me if I thought my work reflected the parakoesis of the Trinity. And I was like, yeah, totally.
Do you think it's a good thing if it does? Then yes.
I learned a bunch of words. I wrote them down in my notebook from that event.
This event was 2 days, and I completely missed the first day. And on the second day, I showed up, and Scott spoke before you. And in between that time, I struck up a conversation with Scott, and we started talking. And I wound up taking him to the airport, so I missed you completely.
Oh, Scott, such a diva.
We were talking about it. I was asking him how the conference had gone, and he was saying... he was saying how great you were the previous day when he got to see you.
Aww,
and he said that you were, for one thing, you were just hilarious, that you like had everybody in stitches, and it was just fantastic. And I had heard somewhere that you were something like the Tennessee's like humorist of the year at some point. Is that right?
Oh, I think back when I wrote a column, that makes it sound so much more exciting than it is. Back when I wrote a column for the local paper, like the local Dayton, Tennessee paper. So circulation, like mom and some other people. I used to write a little humor column for them, and it did win the Tennessee Press Association Award for Best Humor Column. They paid me every year. They paid me with a ham at Christmas.
That's something.
Yeah, you got to pay your dues. But,
well, I was thinking about that, and I was reminded of a story that one of my friends told me one time about when he was in seminary, which wasn't long ago. He was going to a fairly conservative to moderate seminary, and they brought Rob Bell in, and this was after Love Wins, and my friend was saying there were plenty of people there who kind of had a chip on their shoulder and were just kind of waiting to give it to Rob. And he said, in a matter of seconds after taking the stage, Rob Bell had just completely won over the audience with his humor and his charisma. And I wonder if that's something that you're conscious of when you're speaking somewhere, that ability to use that kind of human touch to diffuse what could be maybe a hot exchange.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me and said, "You're not angry." And I don't know if it's just because of the notion of angry feminists or something is just in their heads when they think about me or what. But, oh, yeah, a little bit of humor and just honesty can really go a long way when it comes to just relating to people in general. And certainly when you're speaking, it helps. A Southern accent doesn't hurt. So sometimes if I'm feeling a little cornered or something, I'll turn it up a few decibels. Just say, "Oh, well, bless your heart. Thanks so much for coming." You know, just turn it on a bit. But yeah, but it comes pretty naturally too, to just kind of, I don't know, tell a few jokes and tell some stories. And that seems like the best way to interact with any group of people, including an audience. And it does seem to kind of diffuse some of the hostility that can come into it. I think so many of us know one another for our online interactions, and it's so hard to communicate tone and intent on Twitter and Facebook. And I am not great at that, especially when somebody says something that irritates me on Twitter. So, you know, just in person in general changes the dynamics of any conversation.
And it's so much more humanizing. I mean, I think it's basically what you were saying, but just we're so reminded when someone is there in real life that, oh, yeah, this is a human being like I am, too.
Yeah, exactly. And it's reciprocal, too, because it's so important for me to see my readers and the people who follow my work or happen to be at the conference, you know, as human beings, too, because it becomes really easy for me to kind of dehumanize the people that I write for. So even when I have gotten burned out on speaking in the past, I don't ever really want to quit that. You know, I've tried to scale back a bit, but it's important for me to have those meetings, especially like in line afterwards when I'm signing books or just chatting with people. You know, I've had some really special moments just hugging people and crying with people and talking with them. And it's a really important reminder to me that, you know, I'm doing this work and writing for actual people who can be touched by it. And it's a good thing to do.
The new book that we're here to talk about, Searching for Sunday, you detail a lot of just the doubt that you've gone through in your life with Christianity. And you talk a little bit about how there were a lot of Christians around you who were either blaming you for your doubt or writing you off. And there's a part in the book where you said your mother would tell you that they're not rejecting you for being different, but they're rejecting you for being familiar.
Mm, yeah.
That's real wisdom.
That's some mom wisdom.
That is some mom wisdom.
Like she's a wise lady.
It sounds like they were, your mom at least, and you know, I assume your dad to an extent, was also, were really walking with you through that.
Yeah, I'm really fortunate. My parents have been super supportive through this whole experience, which includes their daughter blogging about all of her doubts about Christianity and her complete misalignment with the sort of conservative evangelical culture from which we all emerged and in the community we live in. And they have been super great and so kind and have just been really patient and grace-filled as I've gone through this. And I haven't always been graceful about it either. I think when you're, especially when you're a young adult and you're starting to think things through on your own, there's this tendency to kind of sort of demean or, you know, almost, there's a sense of rejection and frustration with what you were raised with. And I didn't always communicate my differences gracefully, but they always responded gracefully. And so in that way, they've really modeled for me what it means to disagree with people graciously and to be patient with people as their faith changes and stretches and grows. So yeah. And I think my mom was right about that. I think, you know, people in my community got a little weirded out when the girl who had always won the sword drills and had always been kind of the Bible girl started to doubt her faith. That, I think that can be unnerving for people when somebody who they thought was always going to be faithful starts to question and challenge things. But I think, like my mom said, it might have more to do with our insecurities and our questions than it does with condemnation. I don't know that people wanted to condemn me. I think they felt that if they could fix me, then it wouldn't happen to them.
Yeah. So the pretense is kind of like you are being unfaithful with your, and that's causing you to doubt, or vice versa. Your doubts are causing you to be unfaithful.
Right. I mean, everybody was always asking me if I was having sex with my boyfriend. It's like, no, that's not why I'm questioning whether the earth is 6,000 years old. I promise. It is an unrelated issue. But yeah, it was crazy how often people make assumptions about why you might be asking these questions.
Yeah. Why you might choose to have intellectual difficulties with your faith. One of my friends, Austin Fisher, who wrote a book, I think you actually gave a blurb about it, Young Restless, No Longer Reformed. He said one thing in that book that reminded me of some things that you said, that sometimes when our own theological house falls down, sometimes we start roaming the neighborhood and throwing rocks at other people's houses. It sounds like something that you kind of went through yourself.
Oh, totally. Totally. Because it's just like you're in this state of, I don't know, it's really hard. My parents were never fundamentalist, but much of the culture in which I grew up was, in fact, fundamentalist. And I didn't really know how else to engage my faith without a level of certainty and without a level of condemnation of others. So it's like when you start to rethink and question your fundamentalism, it's actually really easy to do that in a fundamentalist way, to kind of keep the same posture, but with different beliefs. And so I did that quite often, and I still struggle with that sometimes. Though I think as you get older, you maybe hold all of your beliefs a little bit more with an open hand. But yeah, that's certainly a part of the journey, I think, and a part of maturity. And I think it happens to a lot of young adults. I certainly don't think I'm alone.
I think I struggle with that too. And I think a lot of it comes from, if you hear someone espousing a theology, especially one that you've abandoned, but to abandon it, that means you held it yourself at one point. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it's like you feel as if they think that you're whatever, not faithful enough, or you don't love Jesus enough to believe mm-hmm. those things. And you're coming from a point of not being naive, like you've been there, but you feel like they have not considered all the things that you've now considered. And that's why it's so easy for them to believe that thing.
Right. The thing is, often you're so lonely in this experience. This is at least my life. I felt like I am the only one experiencing this. And so I kind of approached my doubt the same way I had once approached my faith, with this like evangelism attitude to it, where I wanted to make everyone doubt along with me and ask the same questions. So there were times when I would just rock the boat for the sake of rocking the boat, you know, like I had to learn the hard way that a baby shower is not the ideal time to bring up the problem of evil and the Holocaust. You know, not everybody is in that headspace. So I kind of tried to drag people along with me unwittingly, to sort of rush them into asking the same questions that I was asking. And I'm still having to repair some relationships as a result of that, because of sort of my desperation to not be alone in the experience, which is one reason why I write what I write, is because I want people to know that they're not alone, and that they don't have to force all their friends and family along with them, that there's some other folks out there for them to talk to.
I have to say, I do love that this kind of comes up over and over again in the book. I love your propensity to talk about serious and borderline depressing subjects at social functions.
Like, since childhood, this has been a huge problem for me. Like, I had a real hard time with Anne Frank.
Right. That's the one I was thinking about.
And so, like, even in, like, church functions, like the ladies' tea or whatever that I'm supposed to be behaving at, I would be like, let's talk about Anne Frank and whether or not she's in hell. You know, like, this was what was always on my mind.
About the Holocaust.
Right.
How do you feel like you've come out on the other side? Like, what's a better way to navigate that, those doubts, in a way that does them justice, but isn't just hurling rocks at other people's theological right. houses?
I think a big part of it is just accepting that it's going to be there, these doubts, these questions. That, like, the first few years, you're just so horrified that it's happening to you that you just kind of freak out. You know, you go a little crazy with it, and you're fighting it so hard. There's a point when I think I just kind of relaxed into it and was like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to be one of those people of faith who doubts. And I don't know if that's ever just going to, those doubts and questions are ever going to just go away. I might as well kind of make friends with them. You know, they're here. All right. And so now it's like, you've kind of make peace with it, I guess. And it doesn't seem like such a violation. And, you know, you see the faithfulness of Christ throughout the doubts. It's not like I've been abandoned by Christ. It's not like I've been abandoned by the church. And so, yeah, life kind of just goes on, and now doubt is a part of it. And yeah, there's still some Sunday mornings when I go to church and we're saying the Nicene Creed, and I'm not sure I believe a word of it, but the lady next to me sure seems to. And it's almost like her voice carries me through it, and she's believing for me today. So there's little ways, I guess, that I've learned to make peace with the fact that I don't have all this figured out and maybe never will.
It's so fascinating to me, because I think that there's really something good about your being vocal about those doubts. Because I can think in my life, I've had two that I can really, that were very, very distinct seasons of doubt in my life. And I still, I have doubts that linger, that I carry with me, that were times that were specific. And one was when I was 12 years old, and one was when I had just gone to college, and they were overwhelming and they were depressing and scary. Mm-hmm. Like, it was that. And my tendency, and probably in all things in life when things happen to me, is not to be vocal about it, but is to retreat, is to kind of go silent. And I think, you know, I eventually pulled out of that kind of dark, extreme doubt, but I wonder how much easier it would have been if I had just been more open about that and upfront about that. And, you know, maybe it would have been poorly received, but maybe not. Maybe I'm not giving the people around me enough credit at the time that it could have helped a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say. It's like everybody reacts a little bit differently, and you're always surprised by how people react. Like, I mean, I'm on prayer request list for churches I don't even go to. So there's that side of things. But then there's like the, you know, the elderly lady who's like this big matriarch of the town who calls me up. I don't even know her that well. Calls me up one day and says, hey, I've been having these questions my whole life too. You're not alone. You know, it's really surprising how different people respond. But I think also, you know, you sound a little bit more like my husband, like Dan, who is more of an internal processor.
Definitely.
You know, like, he kind of thinks things out quietly on his own, doesn't have to make a big old stink and have a blog about it like I do. And I think it takes both types. And he's been a real encouragement to me just in his kind of quiet faithfulness through my very vocal up and downs. So Yeah. But, you know, you never know. Sometimes I wonder if my church would have been the church that I grew up in that I eventually left. Sometimes I wonder if they would have given me more space than I assumed they would give me. There are some things that I wish I had been more honest with them about before leaving, and just to maybe see. But I don't know. You can never tell. And everybody's different. And we all process our doubts differently. And sometimes it's just really hard to even put words to our doubts and to explain what we're feeling. I mean, for me, the reason I'm so vocal about it is because writing is such a big part of how I process things and how I make sense of the world around me. So it's very natural for me to write about it to begin with. But other people have different ways of processing, and, you know, to each his own.
You bring up an interesting point that I was going to bring up, which you talk about your previous church. One of the things that I thought about as I was reading was that however well this book does, which I think is going to be very well, I think you probably could have sold more if you exclusively, we'll go with the word crapped, if you exclusively crapped on church. Right. But you really made an effort to highlight the positive things that happen in church, and not just the type of churches that you wound up in, but the church that you left and those type of churches as well.
Yeah. I mean, as a writer, your job is to tell the truth. And the truth is, I was very well loved by the churches that I grew up in and in evangelicalism, and that I'm really grateful for a lot of what I learned there and experienced there. And the truth is, I think it's just so reductive to approach church and even one's personal church story as either all good or all bad. So I really, with this book, wanted to try and avoid sentimentality on the one hand and complete cynicism on the other, which I'm a bit more prone to the cynicism, frankly. So that I was very careful about that, because it's not fair to tell a story about my church experience and only highlight the negative. And it's just not true for most people's church stories. Even people who have left church, even people who were wounded by church, often in the middle of all that were moments of healing and moments of goodness and moments of grace. And I mean, I feel like both as a Christian, I'm obligated to tell the truth about that. But as a writer, I'm obligated to tell the truth about the world as I see it. And I see a lot of grace and goodness in my background and evangelicalism, even though I don't really find myself jiving with it as much these days.
Yeah. And even the pastor of that church, he comes out very well in the book. I mean, you talk about how he made room for people who were different. He did not make room for gossip and things like that. And how, you know, you had a pretty good, like, a time that was hard and was hurtful in many ways, but the last meeting that you had with them, it seemed to be really even.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a good man and was a good pastor, one of the best. And, you know, it would just be really unfair to paint it in any other way. My youth pastor too, Brian Ward, who makes several appearances throughout this book and has probably had more influence on my faith. I mean, as much influence as maybe second to my parents and my husband, but like, Brian Ward, you know, I grew up in a church that forbade women from teaching and leading. Women couldn't even pass the offering plate. And yet my youth pastor gave me a lot of opportunities as a teenager to do just that, to speak, to lead, to, you know, to exercise my gifts. And so as frustrating as it was to be in a church that had limitations on women, at the same time, I discovered a lot of my gifts in that context, ironically, because my youth pastor kind of saw things a little bit differently. So, you know, it's just that it wasn't all good or all bad. It was a mix. And I try to take both with gratitude.
When you left that church, did you at any point think that maybe I'm just done with church?
Oh, yeah. Good? Oh, yeah. Plenty. I mean, I still think that some days when I just don't feel like going, like that's a recurring theme in my life. Yeah, definitely. Oh, I was very burned out when we left. I just felt like, and in this community, this small town buckle of the Bible Belt, I just really didn't think we would find anything else. And then when we tried to plant a church with Brian Ward, with my youth pastor, and then it failed. It was like, well, that's it. Forget it. I tried to be the change. You know, I did all I'm supposed to do. I'm out of here. Peace out. But it really is amazing that now we've found a church that I actually miss when we're not able to go and not able to participate in that community. So yeah, but I've had plenty years long stretches of time where I wanted nothing to do with church. And I think that's a reality for a lot of people.
You mentioned the church that you helped plant, and that's something that you talk about in the book. Do you think that experience gave you a sympathy for and a hesitancy to judge other churches?
Yes. Like nothing like failing spectacularly to make you a little more sympathetic to other people, and especially to pastors. I think it taught me just how much pressure we tend to put on our pastors and how hard that job is, just any clergy. So yeah, I think that experience, I hope, made me a bit more compassionate and less judgmental. Because running a church is hard. It's really hard, and it's taxing, and it's draining, and the expectations we tend to put on our leadership are unfair. So yeah, I hope that that was one of the things I took away from it.
You know, I was a part of a church plant as well that also is not no longer around.
Yeah, we need like a whole club of.
Yeah, we definitely could.
Like, church planting.
You know, I can remember people heaving criticism at us that was criticism that I had given to churches that I had been to before.
Right.
And thinking like, and thinking
we're just not getting fed. And it's like, well, we're getting communion. What do you
expect? Oh my gosh, the we're not getting fed thing. Yeah. Well, absolutely. And I remember sometimes for some of those criticism thinking, yeah, I could see how you could see that. But what you don't know is like what the tremendous amount of work we're all doing to make that different. And thinking, I also didn't consider that when I was so critical of that other church that I was a part of before, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's like, I mean, not to reduce people's concerns to consumerism, because sometimes concerns are really significant and important and totally worth listening to. But you do adjust a bit of the consumer mentality when you are part of leadership or part of the creating end of things, because it's just it's a lot more complicated than it maybe looks on the outside. And so, yeah, I feel like we kind of learned that the hard way. We thought, how hard can it be running a church? Well, it's hard.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. We're poor. We have no real plan. We're not connected with the denomination, but we should be fine.
One of my favorite stories from the very beginning when we were starting our church is I was talking to some, I think a pastor, and he was saying, what kind of model are you guys going to use for your church? And I thought, model?
Well, Jesus, we're just going to follow Jesus.
Exactly. Exactly. Just extreme naivete. You know, in a lot of reviews of the book that I've read, it's been boiled down to your journey from evangelicalism to the mainline. And that really oversimplifies what I read in the book. And it's really kind of a half truth.
Yeah.
Because for one, you've been really vocal about not completely giving up on evangelicalism. And also, you know, it struck me that in the book, you weren't near as much of a champion or promoter of mainline church as I expected you to be.
Right.
Based on the reviews.
Right. Yeah. It's like, and then this is just, I guess, the human compulsion to categorize. We're just really obsessed with labels and where do we file this person? When I think most of us don't really fit that neatly into a category, especially when it comes to faith stuff. You know, I don't know. I was never that great of an evangelical. There were issues I had. And then I don't know if I'm a good Episcopalian or not. I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of a mix of both. And I like to think that I take some of evangelicalism with me. But yeah, it's been a little disheartening to see the book reduced to the question of, is Rachel an evangelical? Because for me, that is not the guiding question in the book. The guiding question in the book is church valuable? Is church worth it? Does the church have any hope to offer this world? And the question is yes. And I try to answer that in a very ecumenical way, drawing from quite a few different traditions, honoring the tradition in which I was raised and speaking warmly about the tradition I find myself in now. So, you know, I didn't see it as kind of like a denominational competition at all. But I think that's just kind of, you know, that the headline Rachel Held Evans Ditches Evangelicalism is just more interesting than Rachel Held Evans explores the degree of the sacrament.
Has a subtle and complicated journey.
bride. I mean, what else are you going to call it? So, you know, it's okay. It's kind of part of a book release is that you find out, oh, that's what they're going to do with it. And it's a little disappointing and irritating at first, but then you just kind of go with it and, you know, accept that that's how some people want to talk about it. But I've heard from so many people who actually read the book who are kind of pleasantly surprised that, oh, this is not about ditching evangelicalism at all. It's kind of about just, it's about the sacraments and it's about church and the deeply personal, but also kind of universal struggle to find church. So yeah, but it doesn't make a great headline.
Well, and it also doesn't seem to be about, you know, now I'm over with the Episcopals who get it all right either.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, like if you're looking for the right church or the perfect denomination, you're never going to find it. Like it's just people. And so, yeah, there are things that about the Episcopal Church that don't strike me as perfect. And that's okay, though. Like it's for now, it's just it's a good place for me to call home. But, you know, you take so much with you, too. Like I'd like to think that I've taken a lot of evangelicalism with me to this new home and that that makes me a better part of it. Yeah, it's not really about extolling the virtues of the mainline Protestant world because I'm kind of new to it. So I don't really know what to say, but they're all very excited to have me. I must have heard the Episcopal Church welcomes you like 900 times. That's great. It's kind of nice to be welcomed.
You know, before I started blogging and podcasting, I thought of evangelicalism as a pretty big tent that included a few things. And then when I started blogging and podcasting, I realized that most people, when they said evangelicals, meant something much more narrow than that. Mm. And to the point where I thought, oh no, like I've been using this word on my podcast and on my blog and had to like write a post about what I meant when I said that I was. And I'm curious what the things are that you hold on to when you say you can't let go of evangelicalism. What are those good things that you hold on to?
Well, I'm kind of curious how that post get all kinds of interest because like anytime you write a blog post about like, hey, what's evangelicalism? It's like, ah, crazy traffic and people are arguing. And
yeah, I feel like, and it's kind of become cliche to do like every blogger has to do their, you know, what's the definition of evangelicalism?
Yeah, well, nobody knows. I'm kind of interested. I'm always interested in people's take on it, though. Like,
well, so, you know, so I think the actual post was like 5 reasons I'm an evangelical and 5 reasons I'm not.
Yeah. Oh, I remember this one. See, I read these with great interest. I'm one of the many people who get suckered in by that.
Good. It worked. It worked. Yeah. So, you know, I was like, one of them was about taking scripture seriously. Mm-hmm. And because I take scripture seriously, I'm going to look into the background in which Paul lived. And so I'm going to look at the context in which and where he talks about women. And so one of the things that I believe in as an evangelical is that women should be affirmed in ministry because I take scripture seriously and as a whole. And I know that, you know, most likely there were women leaders in the churches that Paul was overseeing and he approved of. And I believe that not in spite of my evangelicalism, but because I am an evangelical.
Yeah.
And so like there were a lot of things in that vein.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly kind of like that would be one that I would pick up on the stuff I want to keep is like, I believe that in the authority and value of scripture, that's still really important to me. And also I think evangelicalism's emphasis on personal testimony and like personal connection to faith. That's a really powerful thing that evangelicalism gave me that I'd like to keep around, you know, that personal relationship with Jesus and giving your testimony and that mattering. So those are two distinctives that I think are pretty important to what it means to be evangelical and why I still in many ways am one, I think, maybe.
Evangelical-ish is the term that I've been using a lot.
That's a good one. And I wish the other thing that I love about evangelicalism, or at least how it ought to be, is that it should be very diverse. Like it's more about a movement than a single coherent set of shared beliefs, or at least it seems like it ought to be. But lately, I don't know. It seems like it's become a bit more exclusive and narrow, and certain people aren't allowed to be in. And so that concerns me a little bit. But that what could be a very cool distinctive, the fact that it's a pretty big tent and there's room for a lot of different views and disagreement. But I don't know.
You know, I think you made a great statement a while back about, and it may have been more about, it may have been in the context of fundamentalism, but maybe it was evangelicalism. Anyways, but you said something about that those things really being a posture rather than a set of beliefs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more like how you hold those beliefs, whether you hold them like with a grip, like a death grip, or with an open hand in a posture of surrender, you know, because sometimes God has to come around and change your mind, you know,
like, yeah.
Yeah. So to me, it's a lot more about the posture that one has. And, you know, I mean, I know plenty of evangelicals who have that open posture. So, you know, it's not certainly not all that are trained to make a more narrow definition. But yeah, that seems to me the best attitude to take.
Well, and I can think of times when I've seen online where you'll mention somebody and they'll mention you and there'll be a sharp disagreement or exchange.
What?
And then
I don't know what you're talking about.
Sorry. Yeah. But then I've seen the opposite as well, where I feel like there's someone else who has the same set of beliefs, but there's a beautiful exchange, and it's not that you agree, but the posture is so completely different. I mean, I've seen you talk with Karen Swallow Pryor, who's been on the show. I love Karen.
Yeah.
And have beautiful exchanges about theology and social issues.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Yeah.
But
well, she's got a very disarming personality. You know, she's just a kind.
She's so great. Yeah.
So she and I do not agree on, like, birth control, for example. And we have had lengthy conversations on Twitter about it. But I always feel like she makes an effort to affirm the person she's speaking with as a human being who's beloved by God. You know what I mean? And you get that sense from her. And she doesn't seem to take criticism too personally, which is something I struggle with. You know, it's really easy to take somebody's criticism or disagreement as personally. And a lot of times people make it personal, you know, but she doesn't. She seems able to talk about issues without questioning whether or not our disagreement is because I love Jesus less than she does.
Right.
And I really, really appreciate that as somebody who gets the whole "you don't really love Jesus" thing thrown in her face like all the time. I appreciate that. And she engages with respect, and it goes a really long way. I think, you know, sometimes I feel like not all guys, obviously, but sometimes there can be some condescension, you know, sort of like,
really?
Who is this girl who doesn't have a seminary degree? What right does she have to have thoughts about things, you know? And that really gets me defensive and can make it harder for me to engage somebody, you know, in a positive, healthy way. But yeah, for better or worse, social media gives us the chance to talk with people we might not otherwise get to talk with. And I've had some really productive and engaging conversations, and I've had some not so productive conversations. And I feel like I'm slowly learning how to manage those in a more graceful way myself. You know, I've made plenty of mistakes in the past, but it's still, you know, a big part of it is knowing kind of what your triggers are and what will get you angry. And just as soon as it happens, recognize that that's happening, get out of the conversation or close it off gracefully before you tweet something you regret.
You can't take back. Yeah.
You can't take, because the internet is forever.
It seems to make all the difference in the world when you can tell someone is coming to you and believes that we're both Christians coming to the table with a disagreement, rather than me, who I am the hero of my story, coming against this lesser person.
Right. Yeah.
It just makes all the difference. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
A lot of the book is about you looking for another church. My wife and I, a little over a year ago, found ourselves without a church. And two of the main things that we were looking for was some racial diversity and a place that affirms women in ministry. And there were other things in that list too, but those were kind of a baseline. And we found, even in a city like Austin, that that made the pool of our choices drastically small. And also I found that like a lot of the other things that I wanted in a church had to be cast aside. So, you know, like my Neo-Anabaptist leanings, they don't even make it to the table. And I think I've come to the point where I think that that's all that might be a good thing, that there's not a community that's a direct reflection of Shane Blackshear's brain.
Right, exactly.
And I don't get it all my way all the time.
Right. I don't know why I haven't been able to find a church that does liturgical bluegrass, but that's what I want.
Yeah.
I don't know why this doesn't exist yet, but yeah, I think it's great. It's just like part of what it means to be an actual community. And especially this day and age when we're able, because of the internet and social media, to, if we want to, surround ourselves with like-minded people who see the world in the exact same way we do, and who hold all of our same values and like all the same things we like. We can really tailor our communities more than ever now. I think church is a really excellent way to force yourself out of that mentality that I want to surround myself with everybody who's just like me and thinks like me and I have to have everything my way. Yeah, it's been my experience too. I mean, I've never been a part of a church that did everything my way. And when we tried to do such a church, it failed.
Yeah.
So,
what does that
tell you? So, you know, I think it's a great experience to, you know, maybe worship with us in a style that you don't particularly love, or make a few theological compromises. Like, oh, well, this isn't exactly the tradition I see myself most aligning with, but the community offers something else really exceptional that I want to be a part of. And then you learn to compromise and get along with people who don't see the world exactly the same way you see it. And I think that's very sort of countercultural and a really important reason why I still believe in church and still think that church matters and is important for our generation.
Well, I think you bring up a good point about social media, because we live in this day and age where, like you said, we've got our favorite bloggers that we read on a weekly basis. And then, you know, we can listen to a podcast of our favorite pastor delivering a sermon every week. And I think we get this idea that, man, if I lived in that town where this pastor was, I would go there and things would be perfect. And here where I am, they don't understand me and they don't get it, but these people get it. And it's so elusive. It's so a chasing of the sun and really deceitful, because it's easy to appear like you've got it all together from afar. And I love, there's a quote in your book that you quoted somebody else. You said something about like choosing a church is just choosing like which hot mess you want to belong to.
Yeah. That's Ed Kaczynski.
Oh, it was so good.
Yeah. It's exactly what it is. It's like, I mean, you're going to have to choose. I mean, this is your like your church is kind of like a family, and you don't really even get to choose your siblings, you know? And when you finally have to decide on what church you want to be a part of, it's just which hot mess are you going to join? Because there's going to be drama. There's going to be disagreement. Somebody's going to say something from the pulpit that you don't like and you disagree with, and you feel is a grave injustice to all of humanity. So like, that's just life. That's part of being in community with one another. And I think, and we all of course have certain, I mean, a point at which one's conscience can't really carry it anymore. And we might need to change the community we are a part of, or take a break from church for a while if it's toxic, if it's abusive, if, you know, all of these other things. But even in you find a healthy church, there's going to be problems. It's not going to be exactly the church that you would craft in your brain. And the church that you craft in your brain is not the kind of place I think Jesus wants you to be worshiping.
Yeah.
Because, you know, being a person of faith is not about, you know, worshiping in the church you've crafted in your brain. It's about worshiping in the church that's there and with the people that are there. And, you know, it's not about surrounding yourself with the neighbors you like. It's about surrounding yourself with your neighbors. So, yeah, it's going to involve some compromise, and like, you got to kind of figure out choose your battles, you know, you got to let some stuff go. And, you know, that's just the way it is. I mean, like the church we attend, which I love deeply, and just I'm so happy to be a part of. You know, most Episcopal churches say that, you know, baptized believers are welcome to come to the table.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm like crazy. And I think everybody should come to the table, whether you're baptized or not. And I realize that is a very old tradition. So who am I to try and usurp it? But, you know, that's something that I have just decided, well, I'm going to have to live with the fact that they recommend that baptized sinners or baptized believers come and partake when I think, well, we ought to just invite everybody.
So, yeah.
Of course, there's always the wink and, well, we're not exactly asking.
So. You're not checking cards, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So that makes me feel a little bit better.
As I was reading the book yesterday, one of the thoughts I had, and I tweeted this out, and it looked like a lot of people identified it, that a lot of my spiritual life has been characterized by being disillusioned with the tribe that I'm a part of and finding a new tribe and being idealizing it, getting closer, and then realizing that they're just as screwed up as the previous tribe, and I am too, and that maybe we need to learn it to love an imperfect tribe.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if we have any other choice, really.
Yeah.
And that's something, though, too, I think that you learn as you grow, too, and as you mature. And I try to, when I see people who are like 10 years younger than me, like rebelling against evangelicalism and, you know, throwing around all the new words they've learned, you know, about all that's wrong and deconstructing. I try to be patient because, you know, I was there too. And I think it really is part of just growing up is having that sort of teenage angst about your faith. And I'm better for it, even though I was not always so graceful during those growing pains. So, yeah, but I think now I'm seeing too, as, you know, an adult in my 30s, that, oh, this ideal church just doesn't exist anywhere. And that maybe, and it's kind of like there's no ideal body, you know, and there's no ideal. This is the body that Christ has chosen to move around in the world in. So I guess it's time to just start to love it as it is. That doesn't mean we don't work for more justice. It doesn't mean we don't call out, you know, the problems and injustices and abuses and that sort of thing. But I think we have to be mature enough and gracious enough to recognize that the church, flawed as she is still the bride of Christ and worth caring about and loving.
Well, Rachel, it's been so fantastic to get to talk to you about this book. Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thanks for the good questions and good conversation.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right. Thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that my best I always seem to bring death. But there's still hope for me. This grace that I'm free.